You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and this morning on the Breakfast Grill, we have Sir Terry Morgan, chairman of Crossrail, a major infrastructure project. It's a 118-kilometre railway line costing some 80 billion ringgit, or 14.8 billion pounds, that's under development in London and the home counties of Berkshire, Buckinghamshire and Essex. I'm not familiar with the British landscape, so I don't even know where that is in relation to London. But thank you so much for joining us this morning, Sir Terry.
Thank you.
And
if I could just explain what the route is. Travel into London, you would probably go into Heathrow. And so the railway basically goes from the west of Heathrow to the city centre of London and then to the other side of London beyond into Essex. So it goes right across the middle of London, east to west.
Okay. You know, the British Transport has been in the news recently with that 24-hour strike. And I thought I'd just tap you. As a man who's involved in the issue of transport, it does raise this other question, because we always think of transport as being for the people, but it's also by people. And apparently there was concern over staffing issues. Is the question of unions and workers in transportation something that needs to be thought through as well? I know in some countries transport is kind of defined as an essential service, and essential services get marked out. You know, you can't unionize, you can't go on strike and such. You know, these are practical problems. What are your thoughts about this recent strike and its implications?
Well, your comments about the alternative model is one I envy.
Oh, where you can, in fact, restrict
Where it is an essential service, because it is, particularly in the context of London, it is an essential service. So there's quite a debate. Government tends to be resistant to the idea of imposing law on industrial relations and seem to be trying to limit the opportunities for people to express their disappointment with the situation they're in. It is very political, though, and that's the disappointment to me. I sometimes wonder whose interest is this in. Is this about government versus trade unions? Or is this the trade union trying to represent the best interests of their members? I think it's the former, not the latter. It is something of a disappointment to me. And I suppose in some respects, the other aspect that's critically important in that regard is that the advances of new technology brings different solutions. You need different types of people with new skills. And part of the argument in London is actually that move from a situation that's been in existence for many, many years to an opportunity to try and apply the technology. So as an example, I know with some of the new rail projects that you're doing, running trains without a driver and manned is something that you're doing. That is some of the issues that exist in London today.
You know, you talked about envy and envy of a somewhat authoritarian model of governance. We and authoritarianism, in some sense, worked. We look down at Singapore, that has created a wonderfully designed city. And authoritarian, let's put it this way: strong governments can do many things, including getting land that they need and forcing their designs on the public.
Yeah, I'm resistant to the idea of being authoritative. I think for me, it's much more around the responsibilities of running a railway is with the management. And I think the whole point of a trade union, who perhaps are not necessarily thinking about how best to get the most out of the business rather than actually create a political argument, I think the whole issue around trying to find ways of making it an essential service, but at the same time, ensuring that the responsibility for leading that organization is clearly in place with the management.
Now, just looking back, I'll just give a sense of who you are to our listeners. You were a chief executive of Tube Lines at some point. It's a public-private partnership company that was contracted to maintain and upgrade the infrastructure of the Jubilee, Northern and Piccadilly lines. So you have quite a bit of experience. Have you shared that experience with policymakers in Malaysia?
I briefly mentioned that a little while ago, your Prime Minister visited London. In fact, he also visited Nottingham, where he went to university. And we had an afternoon session with him just explaining exactly what we are doing in terms of infrastructure investment and obviously looking for opportunities to work together.
Yeah, one of the big questions, because it's a global question, is the question of who foots the bill. We look at, you know, the incoming president of the United States, Donald Trump, and his proposal to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. The question there is, and I think he just vaguely mentioned public-private joint ventures and stuff. What is the state of play with the question of financing for huge infrastructure projects like this?
I'm very clear. In your introduction, you mentioned how much Crossrail will cost. There is, in my opinion, there is no way that the private sector can raise that sort of funding, and indeed might even find it very difficult to put together a robust business case, because very often when you're investing in railway, you're also investing in macroeconomics, where you don't get a simple return for the investment you've made. It's the benefits to the economy that you get, which clearly from a government point of view is what they want to do. But recognizing that value to a business that's invested, I think is impossible. So my view has always been that projects of this scale, and they are massive, predominantly have to be funded by the public sector.
But what about countries like Malaysia, where we're also looking for funding with partnerships from other countries? Because China has been the big story for Malaysia, in terms of funding of infrastructure in 2016, because we're going to see that unfold in the next couple of years. Is there a problem you see with this kind of partnership? I mean, you know, by exposing ourselves to, big money from other countries?
In the example that you quoted, Malaysia is not the only country that's been exposed to this new phenomenon of Chinese money coming. Indeed, in the UK, it is also going through the same movement that you've just expressed. I think the importance of a robust engagement between governments is critically important to ensure that the assets that are being developed are for the best of the Malaysian economy, and that the opportunities that come with it. And I think in terms of my Crossrail experience, the important though it is, infrastructure in terms of railway, delivering it on time, on cost, is critically important. But it's also getting to understand the better benefits. So, for example, I arrived here early today because of the uncertainty about whether my travel time would be. I live in London. I would not dream of arriving this early, as I did, in order to make sure I didn't get caught up in the car transport. So that's where you get more efficiency, much more productive output, if indeed you can actually make the investment work generally.
Now, there's also been some controversy about Crossrails in terms of the emphasis on London and, you know, so much money being spent in London. This is a question for all countries, Malaysia included. We're spending so much money on the Klang Valley, KL, maybe to the detriment of, you know, different regions like Sabah and Sarawak. And, you know, they only, you know, after 50 years, they get a major highway. And that's the criticism coming from there. What are your views about this? You know, urban-centred, capital-centred development versus regional development?
I just think it's inevitable. When you look at future projections about how cities will grow, and London and Kuala Lumpur are very similar in that regard, London will require to accommodate another 1 million people over the next 5-6 years. And it's a similar challenge in terms of Kuala Lumpur. So it needs to be invested. I never see it, though, as an either-or. Do you invest in the capital or do you invest in infrastructure programs elsewhere? At the end of the day, what matters for me most is, does it have a good business case? What are the benefits of investing? Indeed, London as a global city has to invest in its infrastructure. So for me, the message was more around in more recent times about, we're going to spend a lot of money, where does it get spent? So there's a huge emphasis on trying to ensure that as much money as possible was spent inside the UK economy. Indeed, 2/3 of the expenditure was not in London and the South East. It was generally across the UK. And it's got other aspects around jobs, skills, sustainability, lots of other things that actually makes these projects something quite substantive.
And I know there's a special dimension to that in terms of jobs. I think you have run a program for unemployed youth around this. Is that a major thing, or is it just a kind of good feel good, CSR kind of moment for the project?
It makes you feel good, that's for certain.
It makes those kids feel good as well, getting a job.
I have to tell you that 50%. Of our apprentices, and we have 650, were not in employment, education or training. So they were the forgotten people. So yes, we are very proud of the number of people who've got into work. And indeed, one of the things that has happened as a consequence is that young people who perhaps feel as though they've been neglected suddenly have ambition and a future. And so they've developed themselves and now continue to develop themselves once they can get into the world of work.
How did you come upon this this proposal or this initiative? I mean, it seems kind of by the by, you're creating an 80 billion ringgit train line. Why would you care about questions of, you know, youth unemployment?
Because it's so big. It's a quite an allocation of public money to invest in the railway. And for me, it's an obligation to actually broaden the agenda to make sure that we are creating as much opportunity for young people in our economy. If I could use one example, we needed about 1,000 people of a certain skill set. We looked in the UK and we came to the conclusion of that 1,000, we could identify 700. Average age, 55. Not sustainable. And so we're not going to bridge the gap immediately. But the importance, and I think that's true of many countries, at the priority on investing in infrastructure means that you're going to need a skill set going forward. And for me, trying to create those opportunities for young people to come into the infrastructure world is a very definite benefit to the program.
I'm speaking to Sir Terry Morgan, chairman of Crossrail, a major railway line under development in London. Next, we speak about other trade-offs in the Crossline initiative. I'll be back very soon. BFM 89.9. If you've just joined us, I'm Sharad Kutan. I'm speaking to Sir Terry Morgan, chairman of Crossrail, a major railway line under development in London. Sir, we have a question from a listener. It says, what about the development of bus rapid transit systems? It says that research has shown that it's 30 times cheaper to have a bus system as opposed to a rail system. Your thoughts?
I'm not sure. There's a role for both. But I think in terms of when you're talking about inner cities, the thought that you're going to put more traffic on the roads in order for people to travel by bus strikes me as being adding to the problem, not actually addressing the problem. There's a role for both. In other words, I know you have lots and lots of developments around the outer circle of Kuala Lumpur. Using bus transport to take people to a station and then travelling on the rail into Kuala Lumpur strikes me as the sort of experience that London has got, which is that it's got quite an integrated transport system, combination of buses, trams, river, and buses. And I think getting the right combination is correct. It's the right way to do it. I was struck very recently. I went to Riyadh in Saudi, and they are spending some huge amounts of money on building for the first time their own rail system. And that's based on stations, satellite stations, buses coming in, buses coming into the stations, but keeping them out of the city.
What I understand with the bus rapid transit systems is that based on the assumption that you can have dedicated bus lanes. And I think Jakarta is experimenting with this. The big problem they have, of course, is making sure that the motorbikes and the cars do not invade the bus lane. And so they have, you know, people sort of, you know, stationed there. And maybe that's an unnecessary cost. But, the question, I guess, the debate will continue as to whether buses ultimately are friendlier, better for cities. Okay. Than rail is?
It's certainly not friendlier. Environmentally, it's certainly not friendlier. I think debate really for me is just how well used the metro system is. Forgive me for quoting London as an example. The bus routes could not cope with the amount of travel. So if I take one day, just a month ago, 2 million passengers travelled on the underground. Buses could never cope with that amount of traffic. It would just completely clog up the roads. Even though they have dedicated lanes, it would just make the situation even worse.
The question also arises, and I remember in Singapore several decades ago, there was a public debate, meaning despite the somewhat authoritarian ways of that government, they in fact had televised debates on buses versus trains. They did a lot of consultation with the public. Is that something that went into the process for Crossrail? Is public consultation very important in public transport plans?
The answer is yes. I'm not aware of much of a debate about looking at bus transport versus train transport. What is true is that there's a very robust case to justify almost a £15 billion sterling investment against all the other demands that are placed on government in terms of priorities. a lot of discussion around that, and indeed lots of discussion about the best route to follow. 10 years ago, quite controversial. We're 8 years into our program. Everybody says, me too, I want one of these stations. And we've got quite a few stations being built, and people are now starting to see the advantages of having access to a new commuter service.
What is it that the public, that you say, changed its mind, that they didn't see in the first instance and they later came to see?
I think there's an element of, again, I'm not sure how well this travels, what I called not in my backyard.
NIMBY, I think it's.
NIMBY is the word. And what that basically says is, yes, I want it, but I don't want it to affect the quality of my life. And, of course, the difficulty is that there are some people who naturally want to oppose change and frighten people by the potential consequences as they see it of investing in rail. I have to say that once we had started, and we had to work very hard at making sure that we worked with the community in terms of the intrusion that we were doing with the investment, it's gone extremely well. And, of course, now those people who live on the route are now seeing the benefits, because I think it's happened globally. You build a railway, you create regeneration. And the two things have always gone together. And right now in London, 50% of the planning applications for developing buildings cite Crossrail as the reasons why they're doing it now.
But some people are upset, and I wanted to ask you whether you think they're justifiably upset. There are arts spaces and venues that have had to kind of been sacrificed for the development of the route. We also have, I think there was an instance of some archaeological find that became an issue of controversy. What's your feeling on these trade-offs?
Well, I can only tell you with my experience. You mentioned archaeology. It wasn't so much controversy. It was just that we spent a lot of time actually excavating the archaeology of London. We've written 6 books to date on what we found. We've collected and preserved all that we've found. It's a fascinating indication of London as it was 400 or 500 years ago and longer. In fact, we found on one of our sites Roman roads. And interestingly for me, the road was there, had been there for quite some time, had been repaired a number of times too. And the engineering that went into that was terrific.
So you're saying that the development has unearthed, maybe inadvertently, something of London's history, but it's had to be displaced, has it?
We've had to move it and protect it. But I think that's just the consequence. The big decision was, are we going to invest £15 billion in a new railway? That was the big political decision. And once that was made, I think most of the other things that it's work to be done, whether it's about how do you deal with local people who are directly impacted, and how do you actually deal with the sort of things we've just discussed in terms of not just archaeology, but when you're tunnelling across a great city, you have a lot of material to move out. And again, we created good stories around that. That meant we didn't use trucks, taking them through the streets of London, or indeed if it was done in Kuala Lumpur, we moved most of it by water, by river, and then we created a bird reserve out of the spoil that we built somewhere about 60 kilometres away from the centre of London. So again, big plus, because we created a bird reserve that now attracts bird watchers. It's a new tourist sector that comes as a consequence of investing in railway.
I want to come back to the question of cost, because that's been asked as well. Again, is there kind of a rule of thumb when it comes to cost? Because I think when Malaysians look at some of these big infrastructure projects, and we are wowed by this. In fact, we had Malaysian media saying this is the next step, or the first step towards modernity, or first world nation. There's a lot of a kind of ideological baggage attached to infrastructure development. But at the end of the day, are we getting the most bang for our buck? And I think that's what some very pragmatic Malaysians ask. How do we know that? How do we, without being an expert in the field of transport financing, how do you understand good value in terms of public transport?
Well, let me turn around the other way. Look at how much money you must be spending on people sat in cars going to work in the morning. Wouldn't it be much more productive if they could travel to work on a fixed time, confident they're going to get there on time, and be more productive? So that's a big plus for me. The whole question then about cost. When you go across a city, whether it's Kuala Lumpur or indeed London, it's complicated. When you're doing high-speed intercity, it depends on the approach of government? Do you have to consult and listen to many people who just don't want it? Or do you, as you do in France, for example, there's a national debate about it, but once the debate's finished, it gets done. You don't get the local protesters, which is some of the things that we've had to accommodate in the UK.
You know, one of the big failures, I think, in some of the infrastructure development in the Klang Valley has been the issue of the first mile, last mile matter. So you zip across the city and then you wait for an interminably long time to get a bus that will take you to your local, you know, to your house or to your area. And is that something that needs to be planned? And why is there always this failure? I mean, I don't know if you know the Malaysian situation, this failure with the first mile and the last mile.
I don't profess to understand. I think the importance that you're making is that there has to be an integrated transport system. So again, in London, you buy a ticket, you can use any mode of transport in London to travel either by bus, by train, by metro, by overground, and indeed on the river you can use one ticket. So the whole thing around integrating, so there is a body called Transport for London, public sector. Most of the delivery is done by the private sector, but the public sector take the responsibility for having integrated transport.
What about the question of cars? Are cars the bane of urban life? Should we be doing more to, for instance, you know, reducing car parks? I mean, some planners say you need to just stop cars coming into the city. You have to, not only incentivize the use of public transport, but actually penalize the use of cars in order for cities to truly work with these systems.
Yeah, well, you may or may not know, but in London, there's a congestion charge. So if you want to drive into London daily, you pay a charge for the cost. That was intended to try and reduce the amount of traffic flow. Of course, politicians are very wary of suggesting that they're going to take people out of cars. And indeed, the technologies that are now starting to emerge in terms of creating less damage to the environment, you know, where cities are now talking about banning internal combustion engine traffic in cities by 2030, is it, to me, inevitable. And so it's a question of a new generation of technology in cars, and indeed the whole aspect about how do you make most efficient use of the car that you own. And maybe indeed you might not even own a car. You'll just rent it for the time you need it and hand it back.
Okay, the question of cost keeps coming back from our listeners.
Yes.
Is there a cost per kilometre rule of thumb that planners can use and the public can sort of refer to get a better understanding of what's bang for your buck?
If I said no, you'd be surprised. Of course there is. But then you end up with the complications about how do you carry out the work without making a city like Kuala Lumpur completely stop. So there are compromises that you have to go through. So there is an estimate, and that's why I was making the point earlier around, is there a national agenda and simplifying it, whereas in my experience in London and indeed around the UK, the need to actually accommodate much more than just building a railway brings cost with it.
What are the main lessons that you think can be learned by other nations? I mean, London's part of a mature economy. It's Britain. It's an old city. What about the new big urban centres of the third world? What can they learn, especially with the kind of constraints and costs that they have?
Well, I can only tell you that don't lack for ambition. It is not just about building a railway. How do you make it successful? And so for me, I use some examples around skills. I mean, how do you create a competence inside the national economy that enables you to do the work more efficiently? And that's a big plus. Secondly, in terms of looking at aspects around developments, how do you actually capture some of the value that's created by the advent of new developments that come with the railway? And again, I think public sector have a role to try and ensure that there's an equal distribution between public and private about who gets the investment opportunities. And it's around things like mentioned environment, the impact that you can create around an investment. And of course, the other thing for me is that if I use Crossrail as an example in London, it will be quite iconic. This will be state-of-the-art, showing the best. And I'm sure any emerging country wants to actually have the opportunity to show off exactly what it's capable of doing.
Well, thank you so much, Sir Terry. We've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. I've been speaking to Sir Terry Morgan, chairman of Crossrail, the major railway line under development in London. I'm Sharad Kutin, and this has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, the business station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.